It was really great being here last week. Looks like there's more people tonight. That's a good thing. We talked a little bit about some history. We talked a little bit about an introduction to the Big Book and Alcoholics Anonymous. I talked about some current topics, some things that as informed, experienced AA members, we, you know, it's kind of our responsibility to be paying attention to, keeping an eye on. And tonight, what I'd like to do is, start moving right into the book. We went over a little bit of the forewords and the preface last week. I want to start on the doctor's opinion. Before I do that, though, I want to set the context of the doctor's opinion. Bill Wilson had been going into Towns Hospital to get detoxed. Bill was what would be described in this book as a low-bottom, hopeless alcoholic. And what a low-bottom, hopeless alcoholic is, it's somebody that's lost the power, choice, and control to stay away from alcohol, and someone who's lost the power, choice, and control to moderate alcohol once they start drinking. If you don't have the ability to stay away from booze, you'll continue to keep drinking it. You'll find ways to drink it. You'll end up drunk, even if you don't want to. And when you start to drink, if you have that craving that alcoholics have, you won't be able to just have a couple. You won't be able to moderately drink. You'll get tongue-chewing, knee-walking, not able to operate your own pants zipper drunk every single time. You know what I mean? You ever get that drunk?
Yeah.
So Bill Wilson was one of those alcoholics, and what would happen is he would go on a run, he'd go on a bender, and he would need to be hospitalized. I mean, he would just go through really, really bad delirium tremens. It talks in his story one time that he was on the fourth floor or something of his brownstone, and he started to go into the DTs, and he dragged his mattress down the stairs all the way to a lower floor because he was afraid he was going to run and jump through the window. And go four stories down onto the pavement. You know, that's the DTs. So when he was coming off these runs, he would need to be detoxed, like many of us. And he would show up at Towns Hospital. He had a relative that had connections at Towns Hospital. So he'd walk in, and they'd say, "Oh, Bill, your bed's over here." And he'd lay down and he'd start the treatments. Now, in his story, they talk a little bit about the belladonna treatments, the hydrotherapy treatments. There's a very, very interesting book out there called Slaying the Dragon. It's written by a wonderful historian who basically did a historical study on alcoholism treatment over the course of the last 400 years. And he talks a little bit about belladonna treatment. He talks a little bit about hydrotherapy in this book. And, hydrotherapy is basically they'll strap you to a cot, roll you into a shower cubicle with multiple heads, and hit you with hot water and cold water and hot water and cold water. And, I don't know how much that really does for your alcoholism, but at least it cleans you up. And belladonna treatment, I've got some personal experience with belladonna. There was the smoking area at high school. I don't know if anybody relates to this. And you'd gather there before high school would start, and you'd pass around the drugs or, whatever to get through the rest of the day. And this one day, this guy brought in a big sack of weeds, and we're all like, "Well, what is that stuff?" And he goes, "It's belladonna, man. Try some. It's like $5. And so a bunch of us bought this belladonna, not knowing what it was or what it was going to do, and ate it. That's just kind of how we were. We'd if you had a pill in your hand, we'd grab it and we'd eat it, and then we'd say, "What was that, by the way?" I don't know how you were in high school, but that's how I was. So we ate this belladonna, and it's a poison. It's a horrible poisonous weed with some hallucinogenic speed-like qualities. And I went partially blind because I would, you know, over-serve myself with whatever you had. And I remember the next day going into school, you know, my vision had returned, and you know, I was saying, "Hey, man, did you go blind too?" You know, that was really, really, really cool. Just insane, insane. And so I can't imagine how they would use belladonna as an alcoholism treatment. You know, they used crazy stuff 7,500 years ago. One of the jobs I had was I worked at Rutgers University for many years, and we were breaking up some of the Quonset Hut buildings there that were staging areas for World War II. This was an area where, you know, they would move a lot of supplies through and then ship them over to Europe for World War II. And we broke up the floor of this place and we found what was the remnants of a drugstore. It was like where they stored the drugs. And I found a full bottle of bronchitis medication. All right, it was a full bottle of bronchitis medication. You want to know what the three main ingredients in this bronchitis medication were? Heroin, strychnine, and creosote. Can you imagine taking that for your cough? For anybody that doesn't know what those are, you know, creosote is what you use to Warmanize lumber. You know, you soak the 2x4s in creosote, and now you have weatherproof lumber. And strychnine is another poison. So they really didn't know what they were doing is basically my point here. And they were treating these people with whatever they could treat them with. Dr. Bob would use a really high power sedative. He used this stuff that would knock you unconscious for 2 or 3 days. You know, he would just knock you out. It was like a knockout formula. So they really didn't know how to handle these people. But Bill was showing up in Towns Hospital time and time again to get detoxed. And they would detox him, and they would basically say to him, you know, "Bill, you really should stop drinking. It's a good idea for you to stop drinking." And Bill say, "Yeah, you know, I'm done this time, and I'll go home and I'll swear, you know, I'll write a statement in the family Bible saying I'm done this time, and you know, I'll be okay." And he never was, you know, he never was. Now what happened was he got 12-stepped by Ebbie Thatcher. Ebbie Thatcher had become involved with a group known as the Oxford Group. What the Oxford Group would do is basically they were an evangelical society, kind of non-denominational society, who were interested in re-examining and practicing first century Christian principles. A lot of the principles that they found in the book of Acts and the four Gospels as far as operational, you know, methodology for us, they tried to practice it. And some of the things that they practiced, and see if this doesn't ring a little bit like the steps, some of the things they practiced was deflation. Okay, that would be like surrender. They practiced restitution, which would be kind of like our making amends. They practiced confession, which would be a little bit like our fifth step. And they practiced prayer and meditation, obviously, and then they practiced witnessing, which would be trying to talk somebody else into having a conversion experience, you know, a religious conversion experience. So they had these basic practices in the Oxford Group. And every once in a while, a drunk would stumble into the Oxford Group, and they would get sober because if they started to practice these spiritual principles, it resulted in sobriety and sometimes recovery. It just did. It's you know, it's not what we know. It's not what we think. It's not what we say. It's not what we believe. It's what we do that brings about a recovery. It's how we act. So they weren't trying to sober up drunks, the Oxford Group. They were trying to save people's souls. But when a drunk would stumble in there and actually practice these principles, the drunks would get sober. And there was, you know, the Oxford Group wasn't the only organization. There was the Emmanuel Movement, the Jacobi Club. You know, I think most of us have heard of the Washingtonians. There were a lot of these groups that if you became involved enough, if you participated in them enough, you would get sober and your life would start to fall into place. Now, Ebbie Thatcher shows up at Bill Wilson's and sits down and basically says, you know, Bill, I think I have a solution here. And the solution basically is, it's a spiritual solution. Now, up until that point in time, in Towns Hospital, there was a classification of alcoholics that these doctors knew they couldn't touch. They knew these alcoholics were hopeless because they could detox them, they could fix some of the chronic physical conditions, they could get them to eat and take vitamins and maybe a little bit of exercise, but they knew as soon as they let them go and they went back out into the real world, they would get drunk. And they knew that this was the classification of the hopeless alcoholic. And the people at Towns, Charlie Towns and William Silkworth, just hated dealing with them. Because, you know, it's, you know, you just know that it's no matter what you do, it's not going to be sufficient to be able to help this person. And when you're dealing with their families, too, it's very, very hard to say to a family member, look, you know, Uncle Harry here is hopeless. He's going to drink himself to death, you know. Protect the fine. I mean, you know, it's really hard to carry that type of a message to the family. So they were, you know, they didn't really like the hopeless alcoholics. Nobody really wanted to deal with them. Normal hospitals, remember, Towns is a hospital specializing in drug and alcohol treatment. There weren't a lot of those back in the mid-30s. And if you went to a regular hospital, the regular hospitals didn't want to take you at this point in time. You know, if you were a chronic alcoholic and you show up for medical treatment all the time, if they could find a way not to take you, they would. Because what we do is we show up in treatment, you know, begging to get in. A day or so later, we start to realize that, hey, they're not doing it right here. You know, that, you know, they should do it my way. And you know, this is wrong and that's wrong. And I'm going to talk to, who's the boss? I need to talk to. And they leave with a resentment, you know, and don't pay their bill. Okay, and a week later they're back. You know, oh, you gotta help me. I mean, who would want to deal with somebody like that? And that's how we show up. You know, so basically, what happens is Bill Wilson gets 12-step by Ebbie Thatcher. He participates in the spiritual renewal process that the Oxford Group had set up. Basically, the tenets and the practices of the Oxford Group. He said, okay, you know, I'm out of plans. I'll give this a shot. And he gets sober. And the reason I think that we're all here tonight is on his detox bed, the thought crosses his mind that there are a lot of alcoholics out there. This news that Ebbie Thatcher brought me, I know that this is a message of depth and weight. I know that if I really dive into this, I'll recover from alcoholism. On his detox bed, he decides to spend the rest of his life carrying the message to alcoholics that still suffer. Now, there was a lot of people that got sober in the Oxford Group. There's books out there that were written by Oxford Group alcoholic members who got sober way before AA. You know, one of my favorites is called I Was a Pagan. You know, that's an old book that was written by an Oxford Group member who was an alcoholic who got sober. And there was one called The Big Bender. That's another one. You know, you can research these old Oxford Group books and see that, you know, there were conversions. There were recoveries way before Bill Wilson. Now, Bill gets about the business of carrying the message to other alcoholics. And one of the things he does is he goes back into Towns Hospital and basically says, Silky, you know, I think I've got it. I think I've got an answer to alcoholism. Let me practice on some of the patients in here. And it says in here, with some misgivings, you know, we allowed him to. And that's basically where the relationship developed between William D. Silkworth, the chief physician at Towns Hospital, and Bill Wilson. Now, when this book was being written, Bill said, "Would you please write, please write something for me? You know, we need a medical estimate of our plan of recovery." Now, Silkworth writing this letter is pretty amazing that he even did it. Because you have to understand, he's from the medical, the scientific part of this whole thing. Everything has to be provable. You know, scientific tests must be repeatable. It needs to be peer reviewed. I mean, you don't just make something up. If you're a scientist, you follow best practices that, you know, come about through a lot of trials and a lot of tribulations. And all of a sudden, Bill Wilson with this religious angle, because you got to remember, the Oxford Group was religious, and there was no AA until this book was published. There was only Oxford Group alcoholic members. For him to basically say, okay, this guy over here who's helping drunks get sober, there's something really significant going on here. There's something that's really working, and we need to pay attention to it. It's amazing, because it's like it would be like a scientist saying, "Hey, you know, yeah, we've got, you know, Beth Israel Hospital behind us, but there's some guys down the street with an Ouija board that are doing better than we are. Let's pay attention to the people with the Ouija board." I mean, it would have been professional suicide for him to do something like that. So he didn't sign the letter. He wrote it, but he didn't sign it, because it was an opinion. Because there was no science behind a spiritual awakening, and there is none today. There's no science behind a spiritual awakening. It's something that is observable, but it's not quantifiable. You know what I mean? And that's one of the reasons why AA and professional treatment have such a distance between each other. Because it's very, very difficult for the scientific community to really understand what the hell goes on in these meetings. You know, we've sent you to the $40,000 treatment centers. We've sent you to 20 of them. And you meet a plumber named Harry in AA and you get sober. You know, what the hell's going on? So, you know, there's a little bit of a friendly distance. Let's just say that. But the fact that Silkworth wrote this letter is amazing. I'm gonna start reading a little bit in here, and I'm gonna read what I think is, you know, the important parts, and just share a little bit on it. "We have Alcoholics Anonymous." This is Bill. "We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health." Because Bill would go in there, and the people that Towns Hospital couldn't help, he would help. If they would participate in the things that he asked them to participate in, they would get sober. "A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter." Now, Silkworth, it was estimated that he treated over 20,000... You know, I'm really bad with numbers. I'm numerically dyslexic, so if I ever quote a number, you know, don't take that to the bank. But, you know, I know it was in the tens of thousands of alcoholics that this guy worked with. That'll give you a clue about what's going on. You'll start to see patterns. You'll start to see classifications. You'll start to see the scale of alcoholism. You'll start to get a clue about, you know, what type of chances certain people have and what type of chances other people don't have. Now, I've got a copy of this original letter. What Bill did, Bill took a little bit of artistic license and took the letter that Silkworth wrote and chopped it up a little bit. And I think he improved on it. He made a lot of sense out of it. But it's very, very interesting to read the original letter, you know, which you can find online if you're so inclined. Anyway, he identifies himself by just saying, "I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 34, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of the type I had come to regard as hopeless." Now, there's still hopeless alcoholics out there. There still are. And a hopeless alcoholic is just someone that self-knowledge is not going to help them. It's not going to recover them. Teaching them relapse prevention techniques is not going to be a long-lasting solution. Showing them where their triggers are is not really going to help them very much when they're on the way to the bar. You know, we're dealing with somebody, you know, right now who we're very, very close to, who decided after going, you know, through like 3 days of outpatient that you know, all this outpatient really is, you know, a drag. I need to go to the bar and, you know, have a drink, you know, just to relax from all this outpatient, you know. I mean, think about it, you know. And it made perfect sense to them. Now, in the course of his third treatment, it actually wasn't his third treatment, it was about his 12th. Because they found records of Bill being admitted to Towns Hospital about 12 times. He acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. Those certain ideas came from Ebby, who shared with him the Osher Group's spiritual practices. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conception to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. Now, this is very, very important. My war cry for the year is, as responsible members of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing, we need to start paying more and more attention to the chapter Working with Others. AA as a whole has moved so far away from the 12-step work that's described in the chapter Working with Others that we should all be ashamed of ourselves, myself included. But what it's stating in here is Bill Wilson's means of recovery was basically sharing that means of recovery with other people. It was very, very important to carry the message to other people in the hospital. And this is something that Silkworth noticed. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. We're going to look back in 50 years, we're going to look back on addiction and alcoholism treatment, and we're going to think that it was unbelievably barbaric. The type of the 28-day programs and the outpatients and all the stuff that's going on now. We're going to look back in 50 years and say, my God, how barbaric that treatment was, because it did not include the families. The families of alcoholics are made so gravely ill. And then we as alcoholics, you know, saunter into AA, you know, get a sponsor, go through the steps, you know, start carrying commitments to detoxes and rehabs and jails, and start to put our lives together. And a lot of times what we're doing is we're moving away from the family who really doesn't understand how ill they are. They're so ill they don't know they're ill. And they don't, and not knowing they're ill, they're not motivated to get any better. You know, so more and more today, really responsible treatment practitioners, and hopefully really responsible AA members, are recognizing that the family really needs to not be ignored. Now, sometimes they want nothing to do with Al-Anon or any of that other stuff or the family programs, and you know, you can't force somebody to do it. But more and more, as responsible and compassionate people, we need to be understanding that some form of help should be available. If it's possible for us to help, we should be helping. Because in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, the families were included in the meetings. If you showed up to one of Dr. Bob's meetings by yourself, he'd say, "Where the hell's your wife? Let's go get her." You know, I mean, they were that serious about including the family. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. There's that word again, recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. That's strong talk. What Silkworth is basically saying is, we charge $2,000 a week, you know, for our treatment. These guys that are coming in and doing it for fun and for free are going to mark a new era in the epoch of alcoholism. Pay attention to what they're doing. It took a lot of guts for him to do this. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. That's very, very powerful. Then Bill is back at it. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered from alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or we were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. Body, mind, spirit. If you're an alcoholic, you are ill, both of the body, of the mind, and the spirit. It's an illness that affects the body, mind, and the spirit. Alcoholism is an unorthodox illness. All right. I happen to have just been convinced in the last 2 months by an addictions doctor about that alcoholism is a disease. I was 95% there. Okay, and I've gone over the hump, and I now am convinced because of the scientific evidence that this doctor presented that alcoholism is a disease. It is most definitely a disease, but it's an unorthodox disease. There's not a lot of other diseases that affect you mentally, that affect you spiritually. Certainly, diseases affect you physically. But when you think about having a disease, you think about going to a doctor, going to some specialists, and getting treated for that disease. And there may be an operation, there may be, you know, antibiotics, who knows? But if you follow that program, you'll be able to get better. You don't have to get a sponsor. You don't have to get a home group. You don't have to put a dollar in the basket every Thursday night. You go to a doctor and you get treated and you get better. Alcoholism, being an unorthodox illness, affecting us both physically, mentally, and spiritually, needs to be treated in an unorthodox manner. This is another area that really freaks out a lot of the medical establishment, a lot of the psychiatric establishment. That sometimes even the people who are treating us for alcoholism in a professional capacity do not understand this. They don't understand the spiritual part. They don't understand that we need to start to become rigorously honest. There are things that make no sense to them. Yet it made a lot of sense to Bill Wilson, because he came from a spiritual program that led to his recovery. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Allergy. You know, allergy is not really the best way to describe what happens to us when we put alcohol in our body. That's one thing that's kind of become clear in the last 20 or 30 years. It's not the best way to describe it. However, if you think of an allergy as an abnormal reaction to a food or a beverage, you can say our abnormal reaction is the phenomenon of craving. When we drink alcohol, what it does is it creates a craving for more alcohol. What happens with the alcoholic is when they take a drink, the drink asks for a second drink, demands another drink, insists on the drink after that, and you end up getting drunk. And how many times have we been out there drinking with normal people, and you know they can have two or three and they've had enough, but once we've started drinking, we got to finish the deal. That's the craving, okay? That's what they call the allergy. I don't know that allergy is the best way to describe it. It's a craving. It's a phenomenon of craving. It's a physical compulsion. Actually, our liver and our pancreas and our whole digestion system and cardiovascular system is crying out for more of that alcohol. And this is why 9 times out of 10 when we drink, we get drunk and we pass out. But we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. We favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is jittery or befogged. But we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. The spiritual basically is the 12-step process. The 12-step process is how to be spiritual 101. Altruism is basically doing things for fun and for free. That's really what altruism is. It's being compassionate. It's being charitable. It's giving of your time. It's having a service ethic. So that's how we work out our problem. We work it out spiritually, and we work it out altruistically. We find ways to be of service. And each one of us needs to do that. Every single time I see somebody that relapses, they've fallen short somewhere. And almost invariably, it's, what were you doing every day to help other people? Nothing. Well, you know, why would you expect to stay sober if you're not doing anything for anybody else? It says in this book 12 places that we have to give back what we have, that we have to put the welfare of other people ahead of our own. I mean, these are instructions in this book. You know, why would you expect to stay sober if you're not living altruistically? Hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery and befogged. Jittery or befogged, that's a 1938 way of saying somebody that is going into alcohol withdrawal or the delirium tremens. You know, one of the things is I believe in wet drunk work. You know, I've done a lot of wet drunk work. I've done enough wet drunk work to know that you keep airline bottles of booze around for the 12-step call and big garbage bags in the back of your car. You know, I mean, I've been around the block enough to know the tools that you need for wet drunk work. Don't try to detox somebody at your house if they go into alcohol withdrawal. One of the things that happens in alcohol withdrawal is your pulse rate, your blood pressure goes up to really, really high levels, and we stroke out, or our aorta pops like a garden hose. And there goes your warranty if that happens. You know what I mean? And you don't want somebody in the back of your car, you know, who's just died. So you need to get them to a detox. Now, I'm not saying our 12-step work has to be put them in a 28-day rehab. You know, put them in long-term rehab. Put them in an IOP. I'm not saying that at all. But when somebody is jittery or befogged, we favor hospitalization. You need to get them safe, physically safe. And a lot of times, what I have those airline bottles of booze for is for in between me getting them at their house and getting them to the hospital. You know, I don't want them going into alcohol withdrawal, you know, on me. So sometimes you have to feed them the booze while you get them to the detox. More often than not, what Dr. Bob would do is he would give you paraldehyde. Paraldehyde is the knockout stuff I was talking about earlier. You know, that just flattens you out for a couple of days. Today, what they'll do is they'll give you Ativan, they'll give you Librium or whatever, just so that you're safe while you detox. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, and he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. So, has anybody in here ever done 12-step work, like, you know, carrying the message to somebody who's in a blackout? You know, I've wasted my time doing that a couple of times. You know, I gave my best pitch, and when I called them in the morning to see how they were doing, they said, "Who the hell are you?" I didn't remember any of it. We need to let them. The best possible time to do 12-step work is when they're actually sober. Here's the second part of the letter. The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those affected with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Here's an important paragraph, but it was very hard for me to understand when I first read it. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. He's basically stating what his problem is with the hopeless alcoholic. Now, and he's writing it like a doctor. I heard somebody many years ago explain it to me from a spiritual angle and not a medical one, and this is how they did it. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual awakening was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. It's very difficult for a doctor to help you have a spiritual awakening or a conversion experience. It's not in their bag of tricks. You can't put it in a needle and push it into their arm. It's something that takes time. It takes one alcoholic really working with another alcoholic. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgivings, we consented. This was basically when Bill started to learn how to do a 12-step call. The original 12-step call is basically going and sitting with somebody and asking them, "Can I talk to you?" You know, it would help me if I could share some stuff about myself. And then you sit with the alcoholic and you tell them your story. When I first showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, there was this wonderful old timer. He got sober in 1959. You know, he'd been around a long time. And he asked me to come over to his house and help him with some stuff. You know, I was out of work, and, you know, if I helped him, he'd pay me to do some stuff. And, you know, I helped him with some work, and then he goes, "Let's sit down at the table." And he sat me down at his kitchen table, and he told me his story. He shared what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. He not only talked about his alcoholism and how that presented and how that manifested, but he talked about his AA experience and how he found a recovery process in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a powerful experience for me. That was an old-fashioned 12-step call. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Our problem is powerlessness. You know, we admit we're powerless over alcohol. If we admit that's our problem, then it's a logical assumption that power is the solution to our problem. And what Dr. Silkworth saw is he saw this power that would bring these alcoholics, chronic alcoholics, back from the gates of death. He saw it happening. He's doing everything he can, you know, in this prominent hospital, specializing in drug and alcohol treatment. But Bill and the boys are actually, the people who are participating with Bill and the boys are having transformational recovery experiences. And, you know, Silkworth is just looking at this, you know, saying basically, great. I'm so glad that there's something that may be of help, because 99 times out of 100, these guys die. These chronic alcoholics die. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological methods can be of maximum benefit. Again, he's saying you need to detox these people. They need to get rid of that physical craving. I'm someone who believes in, you know, accurate terminology. So often we hear things in Alcoholics Anonymous used the wrong way. Someone will raise their hand and they'll be sharing. They'll say, you know, when I came into the program, okay. Well, right there, you don't come into the program. You come into the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you work a 12-step program. The same thing happens with the term craving. You'll hear somebody who's sober 6 months going, man, I was craving a drink last night. Well, you don't crave unless alcohol's in your body. You may be preoccupied with drinking, but you're not craving, because if you were craving, you'd be drunk. Craving is not something that is very easy to beat. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, what is losing your self-confidence? That's being able to make a decision to stay away from booze and have that mean anything. Once they've lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Anybody in here ever sponsor a newcomer? They've got some problems that are astonishingly difficult for them to solve, right? It's because they're trying to solve them. That's why. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Anybody in here ever get the frothy emotional appeal aimed at you? Oh, you know what? Please, you gotta stop drinking for me. I promise. Oh, God. Or else the judge. The judge will give you some frothy emotional appeal. You're going away for 10 years. I'm not drinking anymore. I promise. But none of that works. None of those threats, you know, the family begging you, none of that works. That's not a sufficient defense against the first drink, unfortunately, if you're a chronic alcoholic. And, you know, the whole big book assumes that you're a chronic, low-bottom, hopeless alcoholic. Many people in AA today are not, and that's actually a good thing. If you're not a chronic, low-bottom alcoholic, and you do this stuff, you're going to have the same spiritual awakening and the same shot in the arm as far as quality of life that everybody else gets, you know. But the chronic alcoholic has to do this stuff or they're going to die. Now, that's the difference. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. A message of depth and weight. I believe in carrying a message of depth and weight. I want to tell you about my first experience with AA. This is about 1984, and alcohol consumption was getting my attention. Okay, very, very few things was I able to participate in because drinking was a full time job. I was barely hanging on to some employment, but the second I got out of work, I started drinking hard liquor, and you know, I was in a blackout every night, and that takes a lot of energy to drink like that. You don't have time to like run around and do other stuff. So I decide, man, you know, this guy comes and he doesn't have a place to stay, and I'm in the house by myself for a couple months, and I say, you can stay with me for a while, and I talk him into taking me to an AA meeting. I basically say, you know, my drinking's really, really, I can't not drink, and that's got me concerned, and I feel ill every morning, and I just would like to figure out how to control this thing, so would you take me to an AA meeting? I said, sure. So we went up to this AA meeting in town, and I got drunk to go to it. I figured, doesn't that make sense? You know, it's an AA meeting. Aren't you supposed to drink, you know, when you, especially your first time? So I got a little drunk. Not too drunk, you know, but a little drunk. And I remember walking in, and somebody spotted me from across the room, you know, the new guy, you know, and heads for me, and starts talking to me about sponsorship. You know, yeah, you know, I sponsor. And I'm thinking, I don't know what this guy is talking about. I used to race motorcycles, and Suzuki sponsored me. And if I rode their motorcycle and wore their shirt, they would give me gas money to get to the race. So I'm thinking, this guy wants to give me gas money to get to the meeting. So I don't have a driver's license, you know? So this guy's wasting his time. I didn't know what he was doing. And then I sat down in a chair, and they, you know, everybody's getting coffee. I'm not a coffee drinker. I'm a bourbon drinker, you know? They go around the room. Everybody introduces themselves, and then they say the Serenity Prayer. And, you know, the chills kind of go up my spine during that. And then the basket gets passed. And, you know, the last time I saw a basket gets passed, you know, I was getting married in the Catholic Church. You know, so another chill goes up my spine, you know. And I'm thinking, I must be in the wrong place. And then all of a sudden they start to share. And this was one of those dysfunctional sharing meetings, that, you know, and somebody like, I got this problem, you know, and the fan belt on my Mercedes, and you know, I go to the dealership, and he's really rude to me, and you know, and then you know, somebody else shared some other thing, I can't sell my house, and I bought another house, and now I'm stuck with two mortgages. I don't know what to do. And I'm thinking, how the hell do you get a house? You know what I mean? I'd love to have that problem, you know? How do you get a house? I've got like $4. And you know, and at the end, everybody stands up, and they get in a big circle, you know, and I'm really paranoid to this time. Now they hold my hand. Okay, they grab my hand, they hold my hand. Last time somebody held my hand was in kindergarten. You know what I mean? And they start saying the Lord's Prayer, and I am the hell out of there. And I didn't come back for like 7 years, you know, because that won't work. That won't work on me. Saying the Lord's Prayer won't work on me. I'm in real trouble. You know, it may work for you. I mean, I didn't know that we work out our problems on the spiritual plane. I thought that there was some kind of information or some trick or something that you could learn where you could control your drinking. I just didn't know. So I left because I didn't see an answer there for me. And so often that's what happens to us as alcoholics. You know, if there was a flag we could wave, it would be a flag that says, you don't understand, I'm different. You know, every one of us thinks that when we first come in here. It won't work for me. You need to understand my problems, you know? If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line, see the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder why we have accepted and encouraged this movement. He's basically saying, why are you asking me that I'm promoting this spiritual thing that has no scientific validity whatever? Why am I doing it? It's because I am dreaming about these people I'm working with and how they're dying and the pain and the suffering in their family. That's why I'd do anything to help with that suffering. And that's really what made Dr. Silkworth such a saint. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. There's that word, altruism again. That's the one thing that's slowly deteriorated and eroded from Alcoholics Anonymous, is that altruism. You know, if you're really in trouble with alcoholism, you better really get altruistic. It's going to be incredibly important how much you give in this program. Because you have to give enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to get enough back from Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to stay. What will happen is you'll just wander off, you know, we'll see you for 3 or 4 or 8 months, and then slowly you're just gone, and we're not even thinking about you. You're just gone. You know what I mean? You're not that important, unfortunately, to us. And all of a sudden you're gone. I remember that happened to me the first time I came in, and I went back out for about 6 months. It was really horrible. I contacted my AA contact who became my sponsor, and I said, Phil, I'm really sorry. You know, I went back out. It was really horrible. And he goes, because I didn't even notice you were gone. You know, it was very humbling. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. We certainly do. Alcohol gives us an antidote to our spiritual malady. I don't know about anybody else, but prior to a spiritual awakening in Alcoholics Anonymous, what would happen to me was I was uncomfortable with myself and my environment on a continuing basis. I had a level of anxiety. I just wasn't good. I didn't want to be here with these people doing this stuff. Okay? I just didn't feel right. Now, when I drank a little bit of alcohol, everything was cool. All of a sudden, all right, you know, this is fun. I love these people. You know, what it did was it was an antidote. It was an antidote for my spiritual condition. So I liked the effect that alcohol produced. It gave me freedom. It gave me comfortability in my own skin. And I needed to use it. If I was going to go to a dance or something, I needed ballast. If I was going to go to traffic court or something with all the fluorescent lights and cops, I needed a couple of drinks. You know? Otherwise, I'm going to be really uncomfortable. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And this is something that kills us. We are so sick, we don't even think we're sick. And then we come into AA for a while, and we're so sick that we think you're sicker than us. All right? And then we finally get to the point where we're sick enough that we can recognize we're sick. And we need to get to that point. We need to stay around to be able to get to that point. Otherwise, we're going to die. And we're going to not believe that we're in real trouble and we need this AA stuff. We're just not going to be convinced. So we need to hang in there until the miracle happens. And what the miracle is coming to the realization that you need this miracle. You know? we're dealing with somebody right now that is in so much trouble, but they cannot believe they're in trouble. Instead of going to an AA meeting, it's more important to go to the gym. I mean, you know, think about that. If you had clarity, it would be die an alcoholic death and go to the gym. Go to AA. You know, it would be that clear. But it's not that clear with us. It's not that clear at all. We just don't believe it. We're in way more trouble than we think we are when we first get here. Every single one of us. This is great. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. That's the thing that really got me. You know, everybody else can drink and I can't drink? That's unfair. There's a serious miscarriage of justice somewhere in this. You know, I just can't even believe it. And that was very, very difficult to get past. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of the spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless a person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. This is a doctor. This is a doctor saying this. What happens is we make a firm resolution. I swear I'm not going to drink again, and we end up drunk. This would happen to me every single morning. I would come to in the morning, and I would say, I can't believe how sick I feel. You know, I'm never going to do this again. And I meant it. I was telling the truth. But what would happen is that mental obsession would come on me somewhere in the middle of the afternoon, and I would be driving to a liquor store to start the whole thing out all over again that day after I made a firm resolution not to drink. This is the lack of power, choice, and control that the alcoholic has. This is one of the reasons why we die. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems that he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. An entire psychic change. We need a psychic change. That's the treatment for alcoholism. It's not something that a treatment center can give you. It's not something that a detox can give you. There's very, very few places where you can be exposed to a program of action sufficient to give you a psychic change. Alcoholics Anonymous is one of those places. If you're new, if you're just coming back, or if you've never gone through the steps and you're alcoholic, there's two truths that are so true in your case, but you're not going to believe them. The first we talked about, you're in way more trouble than you think. The second truth is, there's more of an answer for your life and its problems in Alcoholics Anonymous than you're giving AA credit for. When I first walked into AA and I heard people sharing about their Mercedes stand belt, I said, this is nuts. Okay, there's nothing here for me. These people are lame. It's a church basement. It's primetime TV night. You know, these are the losers of all loserdom. I'm out of here. You know what I mean? A happening, stepping guy like me. I can't end up here. Now, that was such a mistaken perception. That was seeing things so wrong. There actually was an unbelievable answer to my life and its problems and its quality. And the problems I was having with relationships and the problems I was having with consistency that would lead to success in my life. All of those problems were answered in Alcoholics Anonymous by a spiritual program. But try to convince me that I was in the right place early on. You know? So if you're new, if you're coming back, you're in way more trouble than you think, but this is the right place to be in trouble at. You know, that's all I have for tonight. Thanks.